Can money buy happiness? It is a heavily researched question, and the consensus is yes, it can. One of the key benefits that money provides is safety and security. Having enough money eliminates anxiety when shopping or making large purchases. Money also affords you memorable life experiences that bring you joy and happiness, allow you to help loved ones, and give back to your community. But just how much money do you need to be happy? I'm Joe Lee. Thanks for joining me for this conversation on WAER Digital. To answer that question, we narrowed the focus of this conversation to how much money and what kind of experiences do the happiest people in retirement have in common. Can money buy happiness? My next guest says yes, up to a point. Helping me explore this question is Wes Moss, host of Money Matters, an investment and personal finance radio show. He's also chief investment strategist at Capital Investment Advisors and author of the book, You Can Retire Sooner Than You Think, The Five Money Secrets of the Happiest Retirees. Welcome to the show, Wes.
Joe, thanks for having me.
I got to tell you, I'm really excited to have you on. I've listened to your book no less than five times.
There's
so much in there. I've taken copious notes, trying to remember things, so I always have to go back and listen. But the thing that struck me about it was it just goes beyond the financial management piece. And really talks about the relationship between money and happiness. And so we're doing a series on happiness and really exploring the question, can money buy happiness? And you've tackled that, and not in a superficial way. So I'd like to get started by having you talk a little bit about the extensive research that you did to go about answering this question.
I've always wondered the same thing. And I think literally as a kid, Joe, I had that same question. And I don't know if that meant like I was a superficial kid or what, but I always had this thought of, does money buy happiness? And I think now it has to do with my father is still 30 plus years in, or almost 40 years, a veterinarian. And we live near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And he's had, over the years, a successful practice and done well, but a lot of his clients were Amish. So when I was like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, I used to go to the Amish farms. And I think the question I had as a little kid was, hey, you got this group of people that live this way, and then you get these Amish folks that literally don't even have electricity.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem really happy. And I think maybe that was the conflict in my head of, well, maybe you don't need money. And then I went and studied economics, and then I've been a financial advisor for now 20 years. And I remember back, again, maybe 10 years ago, hearing an interview or a study that had to do with money and happiness. How much money does it take to be, quote, happy in America? And I think the number was something like $75,000 a year. And that just stuck with me for so many years. And then one day I woke up, and I thought to myself, and I was shaving, and I remember the instant that this happened, that, and I said, why not do a research study and get some empirical data rather than just my opinion? Let me get a real empirical survey and get some real data behind all these questions that relate back to money, how we handle our money, how much we make, our mortgage payments, how much our house is worth, where we spend our money, how much we've saved, and then relate that back to happiness and then see if I can find the money traits of happy versus unhappy people. And that's, and kind of the light went off, like, let me try to find this out. So when I first did this study, I went to, it was a pretty extensive questionnaire. It was 30, let's call it about 30 questions. And it was everything to do from, and the audience was, I want you to take the full complete survey for it to count, had to be either in retirement or within 10 years of retirement. So if you're, let's say, 55 and you're planning to retire at 62, you qualified to, so either in retirement or pretty close to retirement. And tons of different financial questions, in amount of income, do you own a house? If you own a house, is there a mortgage and how much is left? And then a series of happiness questions and sense of purpose questions, and we'll get into some of these things. So I could categorize and take the happiest two quintiles of the research and the least two or the bottom two quintiles in happiness and excluded the middle, and then compared the traits of those two very different groups. Something, I think we had back something like 50-some thousand data points from the survey, because we had full complete surveys from almost 1,500 people, 46 different states, and it was a lot of data.
Wow.
And the data, which was so exciting to me once I got through it and graphed it, and I even went to Georgia Tech University here to get it in the statistics department or the mathematics department to get the data tested for statistical significance, that created a book. It wasn't, I didn't set out to write a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
I set out just to do the research, and it was so interesting to me. I said, I got to write a book about this.
It's fascinating stuff. I mean, you know, because we can, just as an average person who is trying to plan for their retirement, as you know, because you're an advisor and a financial planner, it's a difficult thing for the average person to do, to figure out what is it I'm going to need, how much am I going to need, and how is it going to add significance to my life. And so having these data points to point to it's just very exciting to have, and it breaks it down into layman's terms as well. And you often speak about the three things that money offers. You want to go through those?
Well, the money certainly offers this peace of mind, right? And this is what I don't know. You know, I named the book. It's You Can Retire Sooner Than You Think: The Five Money Secrets of the Happiest Retirees.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I don't even know if happy is the perfect word. Maybe it is peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it is that you fully have a purpose and you're enjoying your life. Maybe it's because you have figured out that experiences are more important than monetary items. So there are a lot of different acronyms that can describe, I think, what this book is about, which somebody that has this eternal sense of curiosity,
mm-hmm.
that has, we can get into this, the right amount of core pursuits, and enough money, but not necessarily your entire life working to get more, right? There's a certain limit to
mm-hmm.
it, so that you can do all these things that really lead to, in my term, it's happiness, but it could be peace of mind, it could be contentment, it could be freedom,
it yes.
could be all these acronyms or these adjectives to describe where most people in America want to land one day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way you spelled it out in the book is it offers safety, so peace of mind, health, because we can at least afford to stay on top of our health, and freedom, we often see retirement as an elusive, or happiness as an elusive goal, and I like that you were able to. Again, maybe not the word. Maybe the word happiness isn't the right word, but you're able to talk to enough people, survey enough people to find out what's the commonality in what makes you content right now. And for those that were honest enough to answer that, I'm not completely content or completely happy, we get to know what that is as well, right?
Well, yes, and I would say that since I even wrote the book, I've even expanded, let's say, on that a little bit, where you've got safety, which is your peace of mind, you've got your health, which is, we have to have that in order to be able to enjoy the money, and then freedom, which is the economic freedom to be able to do the things you want to do. I even lay out now, and I've been writing even more extensively about the happy retiree, as money, adventure, social, and health.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's something I think I've maybe even learned further since the book. It's been out for a couple of years, is that you've got to have all those together in order to have the foundation. And I think of it as, again, money, adventure, social, and health,
mm-hmm.
To be able to have the foundation for a happy retirement. Again, to me, I like the word happiness because it embodies all those things.
Right.
It is all those things kind of under one great umbrella, and that's what we're searching for.
So let's talk a little bit about those research findings. I found them to be extremely interesting. One thing that I never thought about in terms of how fulfilled I would be is having something like core pursuits. And you actually put a number range to how many core pursuits one should have. So talk a little bit about the core pursuits.
Yeah, core pursuits may be, I think I say this about all the research. My favorite part of the research. But this one, I would say, I've even gotten asked to speak at conferences and focus in on this particular data point because it's so important, which is, and I asked the question in the survey, tell me how many, and at the first I didn't need to know what they were. How many core pursuits do you have? And I described it in when I asked the question is a core pursuit is a hobby on steroids. It's not something that's a casual hobby. It's something that you live for. And it's something that you put a lot of emphasis in your life on. And I would say that one example, and it might not be the best example, but since it's the spring and I'm in Atlanta and the Masters is in Augusta, I'll use a golf analogy. And that is, if you're a golfer, if you know golfers, whether you like golf or not, if you know a golfer, they don't want to golf like twice a year or once every couple months. A golfer lives for it to some extent, and they want to do it every week, and they have a social network around it. And they're able. It's a pursuit that you can constantly strive to get better at, so that it keeps you interested and keeps you improving, and keeps you curious about how to get better. Mm-hmm. And it's something that you just put a lot of life emphasis on. And it could be anything. It could be a core pursuit is you're going to be a writer once you stop working, or even before working you stop. You could, and I think I got this from my dad, who is a veterinarian, but had maybe more core pursuits than anybody I know to this day still, because he had so many hobbies. You know, blacksmith, leather worker, rode horses. He's a Civil War reenactor, a pirate reenactor, for God's sakes. Still haven't figured that one out, especially for a guy who gets seasick. And just so many different things that he lives for outside of work.
Mm-hmm.
Music, he's a guitar player, singer, all these different things. Kind of an example to me of saying the more of these things you have, the better. So the research says this. The happy retirees have at least 3.5 core pursuits. The number is actually 3.6. The unhappy group average is only 1.9.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. You've got almost 4 in the happy group and less than 2 in the unhappy group. And it says a lot. I list in the book what the happy group tends to do versus the unhappy group. And it's interesting, but I think it's less important than the actual number, because I don't think it really matters what they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just about the core pursuit that you live for, that you have purpose towards.
I got to tell you, I don't know if you found this to be true when you spoke with people to get anecdotal information, but I found it to be a tough exercise. I really did. When I sat to put pen to paper to think about what are my core pursuits, because I think we get so concentrated on our careers and work and family life that we don't often think about what are the key things that I want to do that bring me some joy. Coming up with 3 or 4 of those was pretty difficult for me.
And this is exactly why I asked the question, because I've been in the money business forever, and for 20-some years, I was an intern in college at a wealth management firm, and now I have my own wealth management firm in Atlanta and several cities around the country with some partners. And, one thing that I noticed is that I had clients over the years that have plenty of money. Let's call it, $5 million, $10 million, $20 million. And sometimes they were less fulfilled and less happy than the folks that had less than $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember thinking, wow, this family or this whole group of families that might be the millionaire next door with $1 million or so has this just has it totally figured out because they're so excited about life. They're so excited about retirement. They have all these things they want to do. And then I've got this group over here that has way more money that seems a little lost in retirement. And it does tend to be the folks that are either business owners that were kind of their life was their business and nothing else. And that it's a very easy thing to have happen. You're so consumed in your business that it's hard to go play golf because you feel guilty or you don't go on cycling trips or you don't have time to read a novel. You don't or to write a novel. You don't have time to do all these other things because you're so involved in your business or you're just, I don't know, running a radio station
mm-hmm.
or you're working kind of all the time, and it's hard to allow yourself for a lot of people. It's hard to give yourself permission to be able to go do these other things because they take time. And so that was a really important thought, and I'm glad it came through in the survey the way it did
mm-hmm.
because it's one of the most unspoken pieces of the equation. Because here's the thing, just like we always, anybody in finance will tell you that one of the very best things you can do with, when it comes to accumulating money is to start early.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just do it. You can't say, okay, I'm 50, I'm 59, I'm going to retire at 62, now I'm going to get started in planning. That doesn't work. You got to do it for a lot of years. The same thing, though, happens for these core pursuits because they're equally as important.
Mm-hmm.
Retirement, if I had to break it down, it's one part your core pursuits. And it's the other part is the money that you have to be able to do them,
mm-hmm.
right? It's the same thing of it's safety, health, freedom, and expanded on that. But if you don't give yourself some runway to develop the core pursuits, to your point, it takes some time, then you're left at 62 or 65. Now you've retired, you have plenty of money, but you're like, okay, now I've got to get started on these things, and that's a tall order.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the book talks, you know, does a decent job at telling people how important it is to start really thinking about it long before you're no longer working.
Yeah, because you have some other sort of commonalities in terms of how much time people spend each year planning for retirement. So sort of the happier folks spent X number of hours per year planning where the unhappy folks didn't, right?
Exactly. So
yeah.
It's the happy folks spent, and this is not a ton of time. You know, when I asked this question in the survey, it was, did you spend 1 hour? Do you spend 2 hours? You know, happy retirees spend, it's about 5 hours per year. Usually more, but at least 5 hours a year. And really, if you think about that, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's consciously an hour or so every quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Every 3 months, you sit down with you and your spouse or you alone, and you put in a full, you put in an hour or two to really review your investments, you review your budget. It's for a lot of folks, it's kind of like, hey, let's go to the dentist once a quarter. So
mm-hmm.
it's not like a fun thing to do. But it is giving you this habit to really focus on the money side of it, which is going to allow you to do all these other things.
Right.
So it's important.
I want to get to that money question in a second because that was the biggie for me, the biggest takeaway in terms of the diminishing returns, but money has in terms of happiness. But before we do that, I want to get into a couple of other research points. One of the things that you found is that the happiest retirees live in the middle. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I call these masters of the middle. One of the things I asked is, you know, where do you shop for clothes? Where do you shop for food? Or which grocery store? I don't know what I was thinking when I just asked all these different questions. Where do you go out to eat? And I noticed that, what kind of car do you drive?
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed in a lot of the data that the happiest retirees were not necessarily having to go to the very highest end stores, right? It wasn't the Beverly Hills walk of Gucci, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was, I call them ultimately, as I've deciphered this data and started to write about it, kind of masters of the middle. I mean, they don't necessarily shop in bargain basement.
So right.
They don't necessarily get their clothes from Walmart. but they might go to Macy's. Mm-hmm. They might go to Kohl's, by the way, which is, it's a pretty nice store, but it's not the most expensive stuff in the world. It's relatively budget conscious, but it's not pinching every single penny. A happy retiree, what I found, the masters of the middle, they're not guilty to spend every penny. And I see some of that, too. I see people that are plenty wealthy, but they actually have so much guilt that they really don't ever want to spend anything. I think the reason that this group I call masters of the middle, they're okay to spend money. They don't feel guilty about it, but they don't need $5 million houses and $250,000 cars to feel good about themselves.
Yeah, that's great information, because I think we tend to think that if we are not experiencing the highest end of things, and we're not truly living. The other commonality was the number of children that someone has, which I found interesting.
Well, I did too, and I'll tell you too soon. I'll try to keep this story short. The number of children was interesting. And I think back when I was writing this, I ended up with, I think at the time we had three kids. And by the way, well, we had three kids at the time. The data came back that the happiest retirees had 2.5 children. And the unhappy retirees had, let's call it a child and a half, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting about that is that I remember my wife wanting to have another child. So, like, let's have a fourth child.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy as life already was. And I said, well, my research shows diminishing marginal returns after children 2.5. And we had another child anyway. So anyway, we have four boys. I have four boys now. The argument didn't work, and I'm glad it didn't. But
now, was there any, I mean, I know sometimes you were collecting data and maybe didn't get into the whys of things, but did you figure out why that was, that having 2.5 children made some folks a little happier than those with 1.5?
Yeah, I think it's, and I've actually done another full survey on this. I haven't announced that I'm going to do a book on it or not. But one of the questions I asked on this new happy retiree survey is how many kids do you have, and how many kids you have, and how many of them do you live? What's the percentage of children you have that you live within driving distance? Within a couple hour drive.
Okay.
And interestingly, and maybe not surprisingly, the rule of thumb that I found for, let's say, adults now families that have adult children, is that the happier retirees live close to at least 50% of their children. It doesn't mean that all, if you have four kids, it doesn't mean all your kids have to, you know, live in the Atlanta area, if I stay in the Atlanta area, to be a happy granddad, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But what it shows me is that obviously family is critically important to the happiness equation, number one. Two, when you get older, there's a lot of, again, comfort, safety, health, freedom, all around the community, social, which is a huge part of what we write about now. I think I learned that from this book too, that you want to be near your kids. You don't have to be near all of them, but you want to be near at least half of them. And that, I think, that more kids makes that easier.
Okay. That makes sense. Now, getting to the money. Here's the big thing.
Now we're going to the
now we're getting it.
The least fun, but maybe the most important.
Most illuminating for me. I mean, I think people think, now, first of all, you wrote this book a few years ago, and statistics around retirement preparedness were alarming, and it's still that way.
It's still that way.
And I think people, now for those that have nothing saved, this will not help. But I think that people, and I was thinking the same thing, was that there had to be this big number, because you never really, you have to go through these formulas and fill out these calculators online to figure out what it is you need. There's never a really easy way to figure that out. And you think you need this big number. And really what you're saying here in with this research and this book is that, yes, money can buy you happiness, but there are diminishing returns after you get to a certain amount. And that's what I found extremely interesting. Talk a little bit about that.
I guess economists would call this concept diminishing marginal returns. So that is, it's you get a return on, let's say, an investment, one for one, then it starts to drop one for one and a half. You still get a return, but it's diminishing in how your returns are. I call this in the book the plateau effect, mm-hmm. which is basically diminishing marginal returns on how much money you have. And as you can imagine, early in the cycle, and this it has to, and the plateau effect happens in a lot of different money. When you look at a lot of different financial measures, if you will, income, the amount of money you have saved. So this plateau effect really takes, or diminishing marginal happiness is what I call in the book as well. It applies to a lot of different financial metrics. So think of it this way. If you make $20,000 a year in America, it's hard to live, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
If you triple that and you get to 60, you have a big jump in, I've increased my income, and I've really increased my peace of mind or sense of security because now I'm not worried about paying the rent. But if you go from $500,000 a year and triple that to $1.5 million, how much more stuff can you do, right? You're already $500,000 a year in income. It's already a lot. You can kind of do what you want. Tripling that doesn't necessarily open up the world, and you can do a whole lot of other things. You've already hit your baseline security.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of this diminishing marginal returns, is that as we get jumps in income in the beginning stages, and as we get jumps in savings in the beginning stages, it means a lot because we got to get to a certain level in America to live. And then you get to a certain point, we'll get to these numbers in a second, then you get to a certain point where you start to, more money doesn't necessarily mean a big jump in happiness, because it doesn't necessarily mean a big jump in peace of mind once you're already there.
Right.
Now, to your other point, and this is another reason I wrote this book, is that Wall Street tends to habitually scare the public on how much they need. And if you think about it, why wouldn't they, right? If you're a publicly traded company and what you do for your shareholders is increase your earnings every year, how do you increase your earnings? You increase the amount of money you manage. So they are obligated to their shareholders to keep collecting money and growing their asset base. So why would they ever be in the business of saying, hey, I think once you get to this level, it's good enough?
Mm-hmm.
No, every survey, and this happens like every month or two, I'll read a new one from XYZ Financial Company that says, Americans aren't prepared for retirement. They need at least $2.6 million to even think they're going to be able to do it. In fact, it wasn't that long ago. I think Susie Orman had a whole issue of Money Magazine where she said that you needed at least $5
million. Yes. Yeah.
And if you lived in, like, New York, you needed $15 million. I'm like, what's the point of that advice when 70% of America has less than $30,000 saved total,
mm-hmm.
right? What's the point of that advice? It doesn't help anybody.
Right.
So what I was able to find in this book, and this was surprising to me, is that the median liquid net worth, meaning the money you can get to, I'm not counting your house equity, your home equity here, but what amount of money is sitting there that can then generate income for you in retirement on top of Social Security, on top of pension, the median amount for the happy retiree group, in order to get to the happy retiree group, the research showed you had to get to $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
Still a big number, and it's that's, again, still a lot of Americans don't get close to that number. But it's also, I think, a lot more attainable than what a lot of Wall Street studies will show you, $2 million, $5 million, you know, Susie's $5 million, whatever that number is. It's attainable. It's not easy. It's not something that everybody does at all. It's still probably only the upper 10% of America, or not even 10%, are able to do that. But that's a number plus Social Security,
mm-hmm.
plus maybe a small pension that gets you in America to be able to have enough income in perpetuity, if you do it right, to not really ever have to worry about money.
Right. Now, there was a bump up in happiness from 500 to, what, 750,000?
Well, it depends on if you look at the median data or the mean data.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I looked at the mean data is that it gives you more of an inflection point, and that's the 500. But yes, as you look at the median data, the happiest retiree group had, call it the 850 range,
right. Mm-hmm.
If you looked at the top two quintiles. But if you look at the median number, that's kind of my inflection point for people to have enough to start not having to worry about if they're going to run out of money and not be able to have enough money per month to live in America.
And then once you get past that point, you're no more happier than the person with the $850,000.
Well, exactly. So
right.
So again, at the top end of the net worth data, let's call it even if you look at the very very highest quintile, let's call that close to $1 million. It just because you had 2 million or 5 million didn't necessarily grow your happiness any more than somebody that had close to $1 million.
Right.
Again, the concept of diminishing marginal happiness when it comes to adding more money to the equation.
Okay. Well, this is just great information. I've listened to the book five times, and it's even better.
Five times I owe you five copies. I should be able to send you five copies.
I'm not even done. I mean, my next road trip from here to my hometown of Baltimore, I'll be listening to it again. So bottom line, this thing for me, in terms of folks that want to shoot for contentment and happiness in terms of retirement, what are some of the top things you recommend that they focus on?
Yeah, I think that if you start with the money side, think of that as multiple income sources, so more and different ways to get your income in retirement is better. Hit the $500,000 mark and have either no mortgage or close to being able to pay the mortgage off.
Yeah, that was a big one, big finding as well, is that either folks had their mortgage paid off or it was very close in sight to being paid off.
Exactly. So that's the financial side of it. The softer side, but arguably just as important, is the core pursuit side.
Mm-hmm.
You need to start developing those core pursuits, and it takes time. You need to take time and focus in on them. Focus in on yourself, because it's a critical piece to the equation for you and your spouse to start working on them. So you've got to spend some time. And just like anything that's important, it is not something that happens easily.
Mm-hmm.
Any new hobby you pick up, it's going to take time, dedication. Anything that's social oriented, you got to put in the effort. You got to show up. And a lot of times, if you're busy, or you have kids, or you have jobs, you got two jobs, you've got obligations, it's hard. And I think my message and what I've maybe even learned post writing the book is just how important that really is, and how that you've got to be able to give yourself permission and motivate yourself that piece of the equation is just as important as the financial piece.
And finally, I have to get rid of my BMW.
Ooh. Yeah, if you're driving around, listen to this interview in a BMW, and you're not retired, the good news is it's not too late. The bad news is you're retired, you got to get rid of it. You got to trade it in. Now, again, couldn't make this up. I had no idea you'd come back this way. But for some reason, the unhappy group in the survey, and their top luxury car was the BMW.
Wow.
I don't know why. I tried to explain it in the book, but that was the data. The top happy retiree car, luxury car, was a Lexus.
Okay.
And you can make and I'll let your audience try to have their own opinion on that. I will say that BMW, I think USA, wrote a blog about how terrible my research was.
Well, I thought in the book you did a pretty good job doing a comparison of the cost of owning those two cars, and Lexus came out on top. Some of the other luxury cars that among the happiest folks were, I think you said Buick and Mercedes, and then there were some mid-level cars as well. But just interesting stuff to think about. Probably not the the key findings in your research, but certainly
it's interest provoking.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely worth a conversation. And my friends are busting my chops on the whole BMW thing. But Wes Moss, I really appreciate you taking time out to talk with me today and sharing your secrets of happy retirees.
Joe, it's such a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you so much, and happy to help. Happy to help.
For WAER Digital, I'm Joe Lee.